Good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. I'm your host for the next 2 hours. We have a really, really, really packed show tonight. Before I get to our main guest, who is going to talk about anomalies and things that go bump in the night in the solar system and new stunning Pluto imagery, I want to pick up on something that happened last night because it was so news-breaking, so groundbreaking, that I actually rearranged our entire show this evening so we could include this, because this is crucial stuff. Normally, in this subject field, when we talk about this kind of material, you don't kind of think that it's going to be breaking news. Well, last night, in the middle of the show, or early this morning, the White House sanctioned the release of another tranche of something like 2,500 documents via the CIA from the Kennedy and Johnson administrations from 1961 to 1969. And we had a caller who called in toward the end of the show to inform me of this. I think her name was Joy. And while we had her on the line, I had her go to the computer and actually go to the CIA website and input a search looking for one particular document. I mean, I had no idea that we might find anything, but it just seemed like something we ought to try. So I said, why don't you type in report from Iron Mountain? And she did. And seconds later, she said, oh, there's four entries here. And I went, oh my God, because this is the release of the official presidential briefings that were given, still are, given to the president every morning by a representative from the CIA. Sometimes it was the DCI himself, the Director of Central Intelligence. Other times it was a designated hitter. You know, we've all seen those great movies with, what's the author? I can't think. Of CIA activities and all that. Well, part of their activities are to brief the president on intelligence matters and projects, et cetera, going on around the world every day. So once I got that information, and then a lot of folks, when we got off the air, sent me links. They sent me detailed comments from other people on Iron Mountain. And then they actually began trying to go through this voluminous file themselves. What's interesting to me is that the report on the CIA website in the library under FOIA requests is very labyrinthian. If you start going through the links, very quickly you find that it's not transparent, it's not easy to access, it's not easy to find the documents. I mean, I was cutting and pasting and taking numbers and putting in the search engines and nothing would come up. Finally, I got it all together and I was able to get a quick little briefing ready for Robin this morning, Dr. Robin Falkoff, because, as I said on the show last night, Robin has been pursuing this story, this remarkable, amazing story, for at least a couple of years. So while I'm doing the show, of course, she's not. She's sleeping. So I had to wait. It was really kind of, you know, agonizing to wait so I could tell her what had come across the transom and what she needed to prepare her audience for. Then, of course, I said, would you like to come on tomorrow morning, and would you like to talk about this? And, of course, that was in a heartbeat. Yeah, yeah. So, without further ado, let me introduce my friend, my significant other, my partner, my life partner, Miss Robin Falkoff, Dr. Robin Falkoff. Robin, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Richard. That was a very unique introduction.
Well, come on. I'm the only person on the planet who can do that, right?
I love the Miss part. That was wonderful. That's always great.
Okay. I'm going to have our other guest wait. I mean, actually, we're taking some time away from Alan here. But at the bottom of the hour, when we go to the break, we're going to bring you two together because I think he'll have some interesting critique and comments based on his background. And then we will segue from this, which actually is very relevant to the rest of our discussion this morning, as you're going to see. So what I want to do now is I want to tell everybody, if you go to othersideofmidnight.com, that's othersideofmidnight.com, and you click on the guest tonight, on the guest link there at the right under the header, and that takes you to the guest page. You'll see at the very top, it says Robin Falkoff and Alan Sturm. scroll down past the imagery. We're gonna skip Pluto for the time being and go directly to Iron Mountain, and then we'll go back to Pluto when we bring Alan on. Item number 7, link number 7, you're going to want to click on that, and you're not going to want to read it. All you're going to want to do is put it on the page and see that it really exists, because the really important links are 8 and 9. 8 and 9 in terms of this story are the really important links this morning, because 8 and 9 are the direct links through the CIA library to the actual presidential files, the presidential brief, the PDB, that's prepared every morning and personally delivered by a rep from the CIA to the president in the Oval Office most of the time, although sometimes it can, you know, take place in other places wherever the president actually is. The number 7 is the actual report. Number 8 is the White House briefing index. If we click on that, that is the index of all of the briefings that were given, and you can see the listing, Presidential Daily Brief, 14 September, 15 September, 16. You scroll down. We have from other sources, and I haven't had time to put that up tonight, but we will later, that the first presidential briefing on Iron Mountain was given on October 1. Now, if you scroll down this page, you'll see there's a Presidential Daily Brief for 30 September, 1967, rather. Then there's a daily brief for 2 October, 67. There's no briefing listed in the library for October 1, 1967, which was the first time that President Lyndon Johnson was briefed on this astonishing and amazing report. Now, why is that important? Well, the reason it's important is because, A, it's listed in other CIA files as having taken place. That's crucial, which means it did take place. But in fact, it's missing from this file because it's missing. Someone took it out. Someone in this list, this chronological list of briefings, simply took this document out. And the fact that they didn't scrub the rest of the record lets us see that it in fact took place, but it's not there. Now, why would it not be there? Well, for that, I want to go to Robin, and I want you to start at the beginning. We only have about 25 minutes here to do this. Give everybody an overview of A, what Iron Mountain was about, ostensibly, and B, why there is any controversy as to its reality at all, which this recent CIA declassification now removes. We now know it was official. The question is, why isn't it in the president's brief when, in fact, other documents say it was?
Okay, I will go ahead with that, but I have one thing to ask you. If you could repeat where this is found, I have a couple of messages on Facebook that people are trying to follow and they didn't get where you said. Okay.
We go to othersideofmidnight.com. That's this program, this show's webpage, othersideofmidnight.com, all run together, one huge word, .com, othersideofmidnight.com. You click on the guest right under the header at the top of the page. It says Alan Sturm. You click on that name, and that takes you to the actual guest page where Robin and Alan's name appear at the top. There's some Pluto images then. You scroll down past them, and that takes you to the numbered links, and you want to click on number 8, because that takes you to the library file of the collection of presidential briefing products from 1961 to 1969, and you want to scroll down on that page to the end of September and the beginning of October, and you'll see there's a big gap. October 1, the Iron Mountain briefing is not here, but we know it should be here from other CIA documents, so we're going to discuss why it would not be here in a public declassification of documents that supposedly is supposed to tell us what the president was briefed on that day.
Okay, well, I will work from my book and the link I provided you, because that's not on my computer. So I'm not getting that, which has got to be why the other people are writing to me that they can't find it. So I guess we should just move on, because,
okay.
I'm trying to refresh, but it's not happening. So what I've started with for a lot of audiences is the basic beginning of the summary and conclusions, because people have so many assumptions about the nature of war and what they consider it to be. And if you read this, and of course, I have to say, so many take issue with this because of the dispassionate nature of the horrific subjects that they talk about. And you have to wonder, is this truly just a select body of some of the top minds in different disciplines that came together, or what other influences have affected this report back then? So the idea that war is not what we think of as an instrument of policy for nations to extend or defend their expressed political values, but more that it's the readiness for contemporary social systems more broadly than their economic and political structures, which it can subsume. And that's just like a beginning idea there. Then it goes through functions, and they have the same basic breakdowns throughout the summary and conclusions of the areas affected, from economic, political, sociological, ecological, and as well as the cultural and scientific. Some of them, as you will see as we get to 8 and we get to the areas there where they are talking about what could happen with the changes, that's where you wonder, how can it parallel what is going on now in society so closely? And to get to some of these others...
Hang on just 1 minute.
Yeah.
The full title, which is, I'm looking now at another library document from the CIA, Report from Iron Mountain on the Possibility and Desirability of Peace. I found the second word, that desirability of peace.
Yes.
An extraordinarily interesting idea, because everybody, if you talk to anybody on the street, they'll say, you know, peace or war? Well, peace, of course. This document actually lays out a case that maybe peace on Earth is not what really is the goal. Even though it's been stated many, many, many times, it's not really the goal of governments or even our government.
Definitely. Definitely. And that's what's so hard for individuals to wrap themselves around, that could be a reality, that there's another agenda, you know, an agenda that doesn't function as we are led to believe, and that leads us down a whole other road, and we see the Orwellian world that we're living in now, and it just makes it all the more. So they talk about substitute functions as we leave behind that little brief explanation of what we think war is and what they feel it is not.
This is in the report from Iron Mountain.
Yes, this is in the report. I have the book here. And I have the paper, the link that I gave you. I have that one up as well. And as you can see, if that link is up on your site.
Yes, it is. It's number 7.
Right. Then they can see all of the breakdowns through there. And, of course, this is slightly different than the book, this page here. But when you go through those substitutions and you see the language that – the foregoing functions of war are essential to survival of the social systems we know today. I mean, does that make sense, Richard?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go on to 2 possible exceptions. They are also essential to any kind of stable social organization that might survive in a warless world. And reading this, you know, you have to do your due diligence when you start into it and you come across all the controversy about what did Leon Lewin really do and what was he forced to say and not.
Lewin's the guy who ostensibly wrote the report.
Yes, that got published in 1967 after the members that met at Iron Mountain to do their brainstorming and think tank approach completed their research to present to the president. And we look at this language, so you see that there are what they're saying about being able to survive in a warless world, that the transition to such a world could be meaningless, because they really find that this has been throughout history going back thousands of years, the way to stabilize society, to motivate society, to keep the machine going and turning.
So the document basically said war is necessary. It's going to always be with us because without it, we won't know what to do with ourselves.
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. That's a very good summation. And when you get into the details and when they talk about substitutions, they lay out things where you have that kind of utopian perspective of possibility with a comprehensive social welfare program that would improve life for everybody.
And you're talking substitutions for war.
Yes, I'm talking about substitutes that people can scroll down to that chapter, and I'm looking at the description and the economic one first. And I know you like this one. I remember when we discussed it when I was first reading all of this, because that idea of improving the general conditions of human life, everybody would wonder, why not? And then to see the following, a giant open-end space research program, but aimed at unreachable targets. What is going on with that? Hmm. Unreachable to be, you know what I'm saying? The contradictions to the accepted values that we place on things are quite glaring here. So you see, they say the third one would be a permanent, ritualized, ultra-elaborate disarmament inspection system and variations of such a system. What are we seeing played out now with Iran?
Mm-hmm.
What is being neglected about what has been going on with Germany for years after the war using proxy countries? You know, you'll get into that, I'm sure, with Joseph Farrell in the future, because he has researched that extensively. It was just a mind blower for me. And here it was all laid out back in the 1960s. And then you look at the political one where you see they're saying an omnipresent, I get chills, Richard, when I read this, virtually omnipotent international police force. The second, an established and recognized extraterrestrial menace.
Now that sounds vaguely familiar.
Oh, yes. And it leads us with one of the first conversations you and I had when I kept asking about Project Bluebeam. But what about Project Bluebeam?
Okay, for folks who just joined us, we're discussing a report which was ostensibly written in 1967, looking at alternative histories in terms of the pursuit of war and activities, human activities on any scale, from nation to multiple nations to the globe, that would occupy them in place of the war state that we've now obviously come very used to. And you're going through a list of the alternatives, some of which included major social programs, international disarmament activities that would be endless, outer space goals that would never be reached, so you'd keep putting money in, but there'd never be any end to the money because there's always another goal and always another thing to reach for, so it would become an open-ended involvement of treasure, resources, people, creativity. And then the final one was aliens, ETs.
But there are two more that are pretty gut-wrenching after that, Richard. And this, when you look at the world now, this is the third one, massive global environmental pollution. We are seeing that. We are seeing such death
in the
Pacific.
You're saying in the document they propose actively polluting the planet to
as
do what?
As a substitute for war, that one of the political ways of achieving their goal would be using massive global environmental pollution.
Now, is this a fight against pollution, or is this deliver pollution and then you go clean it up?
This is delivering pollution and hopefully clean it up.
A never-ending cycle, which takes treasure and people and resources. In other words, this is all about other activities other than war that would occupy the human race, so we wouldn't wind up killing each other directly, but we'd be involved in all these other things that would soak up that energy, that capital, those resources that would actually feed back into the economy, because we all know that what really pulled us out of the Depression decades and decades and decades ago was not all the efforts of FDR. It was basically the beginning of World War II.
Well, yes, definitely. And, you know, gets the machines going, that military-industrial complex that Eisenhower spoke about. And we have building environmental pollution around the world, so many areas. The money is not there because it's being spent on war to clean this up. So we are at a point where you see the extremes of the money spent on war and the degradation of our environments. The fourth one is fictitious alternate enemies. And that is going on right in front of our eyes.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump gave a press conference. Actually, it wasn't a press conference. It was kind of a town hall meeting up in New Hampshire. And he had a caller, not a caller, he had a guy in the audience from White Plains who asked him a question. And the xenophobia, the anti-Muslim sentiment, the vitriol expressed in that question was so emblematic of the programming we've had since 9/11 to hate Muslims, hate Muslims, hate Mexicans, hate everybody. The other fictitious enemies right out of this report, which we now know from the CIA declassification, in fact originated as a study in the White House.
And we have the classic method of divide and conquer being used, because what better distraction is there than to turn men against their fellow men with hating them or whatever rationale that they put forth? People are so frustrated and so disgusted with living in fear, they jump on that. And that's how they get their anger off.
So what was the last one on the list?
Well, there's now the sociological and control, and the point that I was making with the global environmental pollution, it's picked up again in these other categories because they talk about Peace Corps type models to help as a substitute for war, and then a modern, sophisticated form of slavery that would be motivational function, and we're seeing that with people working two and three jobs. They can't make any headway. They have this gets very controversial, the idea of different immigrant populations that they are so underpaid when they come and work in other countries, that's a form of slavery as well. And here again is that thread picked up about intensified environmental pollution. And then the creation for the sociological control function of new religions or other mythologies. Think of all that opens up. And the next, socially oriented blood games, one of the most popular film with sequels is
Game of Thrones.
No, not Game of Thrones. It's the other one. I'm sorry. I will get that. talk about a blank. Anyhow, it's just with Katniss, guys. Anybody want to give a pop-up message?
Okay, look.
I'm sure everybody knows.
I want to context this again. Up until early this morning, this whole document, this whole study, which was supposedly pulled together by Herman Kahn and the folks up at the Hudson Institute, where I've actually been. I actually met Herman Kahn many years ago through our mutual friend Jerry Glenn. The idea behind Iron Mountain, the mythos that grew around it, was this was an official government think tank study pulling in experts, just like Brookings, from military, from politics, education, the diplomatic corps, economists, to basically look big picture at what could human beings do if they weren't so involved in killing each other over various things. And this list of recommendations was not intended originally as this is what we should do. It was this is what one might do if one were to select activities that would be productive. But what we seem to have had, as we seem to have had in many areas, is these recommendations, as opposed to just thinking the unthinkable or the impossible, the scenario playing, which these folks engage in lots and lots of times, someone somewhere at some time decided, gosh, wouldn't it be a nice idea to implement not just one or two, but all of them?
Yes.
Without telling us.
And that's to address all these different areas necessary for society. In the film I was thinking, well, I was thinking but not communicating, was The Hunger Games.
Oh, yes, 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 of course, of course.
And that's socially oriented blood games. Mm-hmm. And you look at the popularity of that and so many other films now. I remember you thought how weird it was, that movie Surrogates, where people are living through their you know, they're android, but it's really avatars, and the avatars have become our sports figures, our entertainment figures, and people are so focused on them because they're so miserable with their lives and the feelings of disempowerment, that they don't count, that they're invisible. So this is the shift in focus that we see, and that gets changed back. There are ways to change that back as well, and they're easy. It just takes people working together again.
And being aware of the programming which has put this in place. This is what's so astonishing, and why last night was such an aha, because up until last night, or this morning, this was all in the realm of, oh, come on, no one could really have gotten a study group together and actually recommended these outrageous things. And then we find in Obama's declassification of presidential briefings from decades and decades and decades ago, from the Kennedy and the Johnson years, oh my God, the president was getting an actual briefing on this document. And when you go to the briefing sheets, which are on the page, the actual briefing where Lyndon Johnson got his first briefing on this is missing.
Yeah.
Which, of course, tells us that it's very, very incendiary. And
of
even
course.
Now, decades after this study, ostensibly an academic study, was done, someone does not want us to know this study was, in fact, implemented. But I got so many emails after the show went off the air of people who found it, and they started saying many of the same things you've been saying. So it's out there. The collective consciousness has been raised to a level where people are beginning to compare these cliff notes of what was projected with what they see on CNN.
I've been covering this for the past 2 years on my shows and on Facebook, frequently reposting the links for this because people don't want to buy the book. They can read it online, and asking for discussion. And periodically we would get lively discussion going, and I've had a couple of people just people from Facebook, I wanted to get a sampling of the population. What do you think about something like this? You know, how does it make you feel? And of course, everybody has that same basic revulsion that this could be an agenda that just makes us into cattle.
Yep. Now, I want everyone to go to othersideofmidnight.com, click on the guest page, and then go down to number 9. And when you click on that, that is the daily brief from October 4th, because the second briefing that Johnson got on this, according to these other CIA documents, the titles, was on the morning of October 4th, which, by the way, was the anniversary of the Soviet Union's putting Sputnik into space 10 years before. Now, if you scroll down the document, you'll see number 1 is a Soviet Union. That's blank. Number 2, Soviet Union. That has a small little Reader's Digest kind of summary, although Secretary McNamara's speech on anti-ballistic missiles is now 2 weeks old. This is for the president. This is what the president actually heard. Moscow has not yet developed a public line on the issue. About all Pravda will say is that the ABM decision is, quote, an attempt by U.S. militarists to intensify the new atomic arms race on the pretext of creating an alleged limited ABM defense. So that's pretty interesting, but that's there. You know, you're seeing what the president was told that morning about what the Soviets had not done in response to the administration's pronouncements of an anti-ICBM program. Then the next one, number 3, says Australia, New Zealand. We don't know what they talked about there. 4 says South Korea. The cabinet shifts announced yesterday were prompted for the most part by internal political considerations. 5 is on Nigeria. 6 is on the Congo. That's been deleted. And then we get to the rest of the pages, and all it says is top secret, top secret, top secret, top secret. That was the Iron Mountain briefing on October 4th, and they won't let us see what the president was told.
Gosh, Well, I wish I could see that page because I will...
Just go to othersideofmidnight.com.
I'm there. It's just not...
Scroll down. Do you see your name and Alan's?
Yes, I do.
Click and then in yellow. Click on that.
Okay.
That's a clickable link. I guess, Ross, we're going to have to make this really clear to people. They have to click on this
stuff.
Okay,
okay.
That takes you to the next page, and these numbered links are on that second guest page.
Got them. Okay, thank you.
So we're going down to number 8 and 9. 8 is the index of all the briefings, and 1 is missing, and 9 is the President's Daily Brief for October 4th. This is for Lyndon Johnson. You get down in the document to see all the expurgated, listings, and there's nothing there for Iron Mountain, and there should be because the other documents tell us that's what he was told that day.
Okay. Yes. This is. I'm very glad I got the right map to get there.
See, it's a two step as opposed to a one step, which is not what we should do. Okay.
Well, you know why it's confusing? Because the guests are numbered. So you're saying go down to this number, and that was it. But I'm sure maybe it's just me.
Okay. All right. Everybody hold it right there. Everybody in the audience. Dr. Falkoff. I can't call you Miss, right? Okay. Okay. Won't do that. Let's see. I'm going to do something here. What we're going to do is go to a break. I also had a lot of email last night from people who love Bob Bright's song, The Other Side of Midnight. So for this break, we're going to play the song into the break, and then we'll come out on the other side, and we'll introduce Robin to Alan, and we will continue our discussion. You are on The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and in fact, we are just moments away from a very, very important new development. So stay tuned. This is Bob Bright.
The other side of midnight. If you really listen hard, you can hear what the universe is saying. Time for you to wander through the mansions in your mind. Nothing to lose, there's everything to find. Other side of midnight. On the other side of midnight, the day has just begun. But somewhere on this pale blue dot, it's midday in the sun. The sun that shines on everyone at some time in the day. And everyone's got something to say. Other side of midnight. The other side of midnight. You can get to thinking. Side of midnight, you can find your place on the other side of midnight.
Welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Thank you, Richard. Nice to be here.
Okay, you heard what Robin said about the Iron Mountain report. What are your thoughts?
Well, earlier this evening was the first time I'd ever even heard of it, so this is all new to me, but everything that's described in the document that I've read so far, and I've just briefly gone through it, doesn't sound much different than any other delicately architected social control system, mm-hmm. and it certainly seems to be the mindset of some thinkers from the 60s, and we were talking about, or you guys were talking about Johnson being briefed on this,
yes.
And I had read somewhere else that he basically hit the roof when mm-hmm. he heard about this. I don't know.
Do you have a source on that? Because to me,
on the Wikipedia page.
Wikipedia, give me a break. Come on.
I'm just saying.
Alan, Wikipedia.
Wikipedia had some referenced information that about the report on Iron Mountain, and
Wikipedia is probably the biggest disinformation source on the planet.
Well, I didn't know that.
You didn't? Most people do. Anything is controversial. I mean, if you had a program in mind, a social engineering program in mind for implementation, where would you put information on it that would get people to think, oh, the officials, you know, the president was totally freaked out by this, when in fact it has become installed. It's become an institution. Look around. That's what Robin is saying. Up until this morning, we always wondered, was this the most elaborate hoax possible, or was it real? Now we know, based on the actual declassification of these documents, that it's real. And now you have to look down the road at who implemented it, and why, and when, and how. But the idea that this was just some crazy, fiction writer's idea of, you know, government gone nuts, that is no longer possible to hold.
Oh, no. I was thinking that it was in keeping with what you two were talking about, and why we're not seeing the report up here as part of this collection.
What I find really compelling, hello, Alan, is,
hello, Robin,
is the reality of what we read here and what has been described, and that's what makes it so verifiable, because we're living what they're forecasting. Mm-hmm. So how can one continue to question and say that this was made up and, you know, it was just a fictional writing, when you can go through category by category and see what's going on now?
Oh, yeah. It certainly reads like lots of the topics that a lot of people talk about today. Then when they're questioning the system and questioning the authenticity of these claims of climate change and everything else, and here they are all listed from in the 1960s by this other gentleman who – you know, apparently, you know, tap danced his way backwards and said, no, it was just a book I made up. You know, it's just a story I made up. And, yeah, it is very interesting.
Well, just imagine all the pressure that was brought to bear on Leon Lewin, on Leonard Lewin.
Let me interrupt here just a second. I didn't give a proper introduction to Alan because, frankly, I got caught up in the, you know, what do you think? But, you know, you served 4 years in the Army as a cavalry scout. That sounds really interesting. You do have a secret clearance.
Did.
You were assigned to the headquarters unit of the elite 2nd or 2/1 air cav unit at Fort Hood, and on and on and on. I mean, you're a guy who, if anybody would know how government behind the scenes functions when it gets studies like this, and then some bright bureaucrats say, oh, wouldn't that be a great idea to actually try this out?
Oh, well, you know, I usually don't vocalize a lot of my thoughts about conspiracy theories, but I can tell you my personal experience about being in the military in the way that it happened to me.
Okay.
You know, I was offered a lot of college money to go in. That's an interesting little bait. And
Back up. You obviously were born, lived somewhere. Where did you grow up?
In St. Louis.
Oh, good old Missouri, center of the country.
Yep.
And you went through school and high school, and then you're looking at college, and you say somebody came at you with a lot of money?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I had a rather large veterans educational fund, $26,000 or $27,000. You know, back in the 80s,
that was actually money. Yes.
Yeah, and and it was kind of pawned off to me as come play war games and learn combat arms. And if you remember who the Cav Scouts are, if you remember the movie Apocalypse Now, the guys with the yellow patch on their arm, with the black horse, that was who I was in with. And some of those guys were still in the military.
And what years was this?
This was from 84 to 89.
Oh, okay. Okay, so way after Vietnam.
Yeah, but my first sergeant survived 3 helicopter crashes in Vietnam. So
lucky guy.
They were still all plenty in circulation when I was there. Mm-hmm. But anyways, my point being is that coming out of the Midwest, as white cracker as could be, you know, I joined the military, and they promised me all kinds of money, and I think, okay, this is the thing to do, and I'm going to go adventure and go to places and see things and learn stuff and blah 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 blah. So I finally end up in Germany, and I'm assigned to the Border Operations Center, where many days of those about two and a half years, I stood close enough to smell the breath of East German Border Patrol and Russian officers that were, you know, at that point in time, the bad guys.
Mm.
And reflecting back to the earlier conversation about this document and...
Well, see, that's why I wanted you to comment, because you have a perspective and a life experience from one side, and I wanted to hear your honest, non-scripted reaction to realizing that everything you did for the appropriate patriotic reasons may, in fact, have had a deeper level of rationale by the folks who brought you into the program.
Oh, you mean the farmers?
Yeah, of course. The farmers.
Of course. You know, I was in the middle of the field right there in Missouri. And, you know, I was promised all kinds of exciting things and some money for doing it.
Did they give you any IQ tests through school?
They didn't give an IQ test. They gave aptitude tests.
Aptitudes, okay.
Yeah.
And did they test you a lot?
Well, they tested us initially, and then we were continuously tested on whatever training we were taught. So, yeah, I mean,
interesting.
Tons of training. I mean, it is its own self-functioning institution, no doubt about it.
Do you think that you were tested more often than your other classmates?
No.
Okay, it was just the regular class-wide testing that took place.
Sure. Yeah, I didn't have anything and everything that I did in the military, I kind of helped carve out myself. So when I got to Germany, I was just a scout that did a ton of war games for a year before in Fort Hood, Texas. And then when I got to Germany, that's when I was standing face-to-face, Top Gun era. You know, that's the Russian, and that's the East German, and I'm standing there, you know, quite often looking down on them from top of a tower, or I'm standing there right there. I mean, there was no fence between us. There were poles between the old Prussian war line had survey marker poles, and the trusted officers in the Russian military and the trusted sergeants from the Border Patrol of the East Germans were allowed to come through their fence, stand between the fence and the border and those poles of the Prussian war line. So,
so was this in Berlin or outside?
No, this was between East and West Germany. So Berlin is buried inside East Germany.
Okay.
So I walked on, I walked along the 72 miles of the border. But anyways, my point is that I stood right there, and this is what I realized very early on. And this is probably why these were at least the seeds of why I never reenlisted. Was I realized standing there with them that all of us would probably rather just go to a guest house and have a beer, talk about family, complain about things, whatever. And none of us actually wanted to kill each other. And which is interesting if we go back to, you know, what you and Robin were talking about earlier. You know, kind of orchestrating a mindset, and you know, you could buy into that. You could buy into it that, you know, that they're the enemy and they hate me and they will kill me any chance they get. And the reality is, it's really not that true. So I do question, in a grand scale, you know, how much of war or the perception of war or even the perception of an alien invasion, as you guys were alluding to, you know, how that all keeps us in check. Yeah, I mean, we could go on and on and on and on about that.
Well, we have a mutual friend, Robin and I do, named Carol Rosin, and I knew Carol long before Robin did, you know, decades ago. Carol worked for Dr. Wernher von Braun, and a name, obviously, that you're familiar with.
Sure, he said that.
Exactly. That's where I'm going. He said there was a plan. There'd be escalators to ramp up to basically an extraterrestrial war footing, because we've got to have enemies. We've got to have diversions. We have to have something, as the Iron Mountain says, that productively, economically, and psychologically keeps us all entrained in a machine designed to chew up people, a few of them, while it benefits, in the larger sense, not only our society, but the globe. And then the question is, how do we break out of that?
How many European and Second World which we were called emerging cultures, mm-hmm. and third world countries are fixated like dogs that chase lizards, fixated on playing soccer or what they call football.
Mm.
You know, and so what about sports activities? And you know that the active males and females.
Well, here in this country, it's football.
Yeah,
I mean every city, even if they're dirt poor, they somehow find the resources to build a huge stadium.
Mm-hmm.
When future archaeologists rediscover Earth, you know, in a million or 2 million years, they're going to wonder why all these circular huge buildings in all of these towns scattered all over this continent.
Yeah.
Are they, are they dilapidated craters? Because of course they'd be in.
That goes back to that Avatar mentality, where it's their team, and they associate more closely with individual players. They relate to them, and it's just a diversion for people.
And like the Hunger Games, football has become more and more and more violent. Did you happen to watch the season opener a couple of weeks ago? They had several major incidents of injury. People carried off the field in a couple, space of a couple hours.
Well, yeah, and I've seen a rise, and I don't even follow sports, but even I have seen a rise in aggression in baseball, where they're just running out there and tackling the pitcher, or people all getting into a fight down at home plate.
Oh, I haven't heard any of that. Gosh.
Oh, yeah, you can watch it. It's almost turning into hockey. And it's such a passive, calm sport that you kind of sit there like a lazy afternoon and watch.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, how can you turn baseball into a violent sport?
Well, they must have been losing their audience, so they had to do something new.
Well, maybe.
One of the exciting things that I found in the document before we found that it had been totally perverted and all kinds of weird things had been, basically emplaced, was the idea that as a counter to war, as a human activity which would be productive as opposed to dissipative of so many things, resources and people and lives and everything, would be the expansive exploration of outer space.
Now that, when Robin mentioned that earlier and then you were commenting on that, I took that to heart because I've had that feeling for a long time and I'm sure you have.
Well, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Because mm-hmm. I realized decades ago, like 30, 40 years now, that I was aware of Iron Mountain, but I was not aware that we were implementing it. Because when I look around, we've had no space program to by any measure of anybody's calibration for the last 30 or 40 years. We've been marking time. We've been going around in LEO. We've been sending probes out, and people don't get excited by probes because probes and robots are not people. People identify with astronauts, with people in interesting situations, exploring, the cutting edge of exploration. So then I began to wonder, well, if in fact the stuff I've been finding is real, and after I decided, based on a lot of analysis and a lot of other people, that, yeah, there's really amazing, weird stuff in the system that NASA's never told us about, I then realized that the recommendation of an expanded space program as part of Iron Mountain was cut off at the knees, because how can you control a society by an endless space program that never returns anything but takes up a lot of money and creative talent if, in fact, there's a whole extraordinarily super-advanced ancient culture all around us in the solar system, leaving ruins all over where there's libraries and science and indicators of immortality and unlimited energy and non-pollution and everything you could imagine on the technological wish list is out there, but the controllers never dared let us see what's really there.
So are you insinuating that they would cover it up and hide it from us?
Hey, let me give you a perspective from a military perspective, and this is just a limited thing. I'm no war games general or anybody like that, but I can tell you this. As people come to me often with pictures from the Clementine missions, mm-hmm. and they're showing me these spots, and I'm like, just don't even bother using these as anomaly research, because this mission was in part funded and operated by the Department of Defense.
What do you mean in part? It was totally funded by the Department of Defense.
Okay, well, I mean there were other people involved, but yes.
Well, they were contractors.
The biggest posse was the Department of Defense people involved. Yes. And it was the Navy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so And the reason I say that is because strictly from a military perspective, you always want the higher ground, and that's physically or conceptually.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the moon is the Earth's highest ground, because you can sit up there and throw a big rock at Earth and kinds of damage.
Did you ever read the Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress?
No.
God. That's the core of Heinlein's story.
Well, there you go. Same idea without even reading that book.
Yeah, so. I did not make a lot of friends at CBS when Cronkite tapped me on the shoulder and I went to advise them a few years ago, because I kept mentioning Heinlein's book, and I'd get these correspondents. Like, Eric Severide looked at me like I'd physically landed from the moon. He said, "You want to do what?" Because I'm talking about, you know, the basis of the book is throwing rocks at Earth to basically separate the lunar colonies so they can become independent in 2076 on the anniversary of the birth of the United States. And he looked at me, and of course you know who Eric Severide is. He, like I had landed from another planet. It was so out of his conceptual space. The same with Ted Koppel. When I briefed him in Washington many years ago, he looked at me, he looked at what I was showing him, and he said, and this is classic, and since I want to get him on this show, I probably shouldn't say this, but I will anyway. He said, but Dick, if this was real, I would know about it.
Yeah, well, so I would never suspect, and if we get around to some of the pictures I'm going to show, I would never suspect that we would see perfectly clear anything, and that could be from a military perspective, or that could be just from a science perspective, in that the advertised position of the science community is that we're here for all of you people, but you know, in reality, I've met a lot of scientists who like to sit on their own data or sit in little collectives and think their own things, because they typically only relate to each other. That's right here in Tucson, Arizona. You know, I've met the astronomers of the world down here, and there's always a tone about them that they are very clicky.
Mm.
And so, you know, I've often wondered if NASA actually has a secondary agenda outside of what we ever might think, in that they just might be interested in keeping it to themselves, like they think nobody else really gives a damn anyway. So I'm just, maybe we should just keep this under wraps. But my point is this: we get a lot of like fishy imagery a lot about everything. Even these Pluto images that I was looking at, I'm like, really? It's this day and age, and this thing's only been flying around for so long, and that's what they could make as a science mission that was going that far away, and that's as good as they could get. And as good as it gets, you still look in there and you can see donut holing of the pixelation in areas where blooming of light blooming around areas, so you get lots of sinuous lines and stuff. And it's like, that's not the terrain. I'm sure that's not the terrain. I'm sure it doesn't look like a bunch of tubes all like tied to each other. And I wonder. I guess is what I'm driving at. If there's another layer of data, just like I know that there's other cube file formats of the Clementine missions that we don't see.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, there has to be. Now,
Let's
back up a little. You start out as a farm kid in the middle of the country, go through school, get thrown a lot of money to go to college and go into the military. You do two tours, whatever.
It was just 4 years, yeah.
Just 4 years. Mm-hmm. Then you come out. How do you get from, you know, U.S. Army to looking at ancient civilizations and ruins on the moon?
Well, I think Robin will find this interesting. I kind of purged my military after I got out, and that first wave of that was constantly talking about the military, all my experiences, my amazing experiences, the craziest stuff that I ever saw that was going on over there or that I was involved in, and I wasn't even in war, you know, I was just in the Cold War, but still, I saw enough, and so I got rid of all that, and I was married at that point, and I moved down to Tucson and went to school, did all the graphic design stuff, learned everything about computers, even
that's where you studied architecture?
Yeah, down at the University of Arizona.
So you were primed to know that architectural geometry has a certain built perceptual base to it. In other words, it's very hard to confuse new structure with new geology.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if I have the wits about me to write that down clearly, but I see it with my eyes. I'm very visual.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some other illustrators as part of our project. I think you're going to be co-opted into what we're up to now, which is to basically blow the doors off this and make it public, because this is the alternative to war. And we need an alternative to war, because when you look at the news, when you look at what's going on this planet, to quote my friend Joseph Farrell, we're in a closed system, and closed systems inevitably go to hell in a handbasket.
Mm-hmm.
They do not survive. They perish. Look at all the ancient civilizations, which we now dig into the sands and excavate, you know, a brick here and a cuneiform tablet there and a, you know, piece of jewelry. And those were once incredibly intelligently exciting, vibrant cultures. What happened? They did not expand. They had to contract because of resources, of limitations, of self-limitation, and they died.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, it's quite shocking when you actually stop and think about it. We've been taught history so much, so often, and in our lives that we just take it for granted. But it's really, really hard to imagine what it was like in Rome or ancient Egypt or anything like that from their perspective. Mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, we can be as historically correct as we can possibly be, but we're always doing that from our modern day perspective, because it's all interpretation at that point.
We don't have that context. Okay, everybody hold it there. When we come back, I'm going to have Alan begin to go through his research, and we'll see interesting cross links to Iron Mountain, because the key inhibitor, I think, to the ultimate infinite exploration of space as an alternative to war is what NASA and the government and, you know, the various administrations, Kennedy on, found is actually out there, which is not a bunch of cold, dark worlds, but incredibly ancient, vibrant cultures that are no longer with us either. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning, Alan Sturm, Dr. Robin Falkov, and we shall return. And good morning, everyone, once again. You're back on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning is Alan Sturm. Robin has gently excused herself because she has a morning show. And it's later in the morning, but it's not that much later, so she has to get a few hours of sleep. So I thank her for her amazing contribution this morning. This is only the beginning of a much larger story and a much larger program we're going to do on Iron Mountain. Sometime next week, we may actually be able to do it earlier rather than later. So I want to thank Robin, and I now want to move on, Alan, to how you transitioned from the military through design into looking at a design where obviously you never imagined it would be, that is, on the moon.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for having me back. I originally intended to make, as a graphic designer, I originally intended to make a book. I saw the book titled Full Moon by Michael Light. Matter of fact, I bought a couple copies of that. And I'm like, how in the world did he get access to these pictures? I mean, this is fascinating. I used to go down in the basement and watch on the Super 8 projector the Apollo movies and that my dad had collected. And somehow that I was completely disconnected from that until many, many years later, you know, in my 30s. And I'm like, how did he get access to that stuff? And so I started just doing a little research online, and I came across the archives. By the way, I was listening to you. And
you mean the NASA archives?
Yeah, yeah. And I had heard you on Coast to Coast, and I had heard John Lear, and I heard other people, and, you know, that was all in the back of my head too. Hmm. But I say that ahead of time because it was really just in the back of my head. What I was fascinated with was making another book similar to this, but my original intent was to find all the pictures that he didn't use, find all the ones that were cruddy and crappy, because I started to find pictures that had smears on them and emulsion problems and developer all over them and just strange stuff, right? So I was like, so I was thinking about that. And then I'm like, I had this brainiac idea since I had done a website for an astronomy shop here in Tucson. And for trade, I got my hands on an 8-inch telescope. And so I was like, I'm going to take the best picture I can of a spot on the moon with this 8-inch telescope, which is a reasonable mid-range telescope. And then I'll go find in the public archives a similar picture. And then I'll put those, you know, face to face on every page. You know, on one side, I would have the best picture I could take. And on the other side, I would have the picture of that area, whether it was these lunar orbiter pictures or the command module or whatever. And so I started digging into them, and I started requesting photos that weren't available.
Was this from the National Space Science Data Center, actual images,
This is from the LPI archives.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, it was a little different. I had phone conversations and email conversations with them.
Oh, that's right. You're right there in Tucson, so you could just walk over and take a look at their archives.
Right. Well, yes, Tucson, the University of Arizona does have one of the archives here. There's like a dozen of them in the world. But they didn't have a lot of the regular Hasselblad images that they had a lot of the lunar orbiter photography here.
Mm-hmm.
But they did have access to all the other archives. And as well, I got access to LPI itself. And so eventually, through the requests and all that and the number of requests that I was making, and I was being polite and asking if they couldn't find it right away, they made an FTP spot for me, and they started uploading these images onto a drive that I could just go up and download. And you mentioned Alan Stern earlier. I'm curious if anybody ever misinterpreted my name for someone else's name in NASA. But anyways, I ended up
Hang on. That's really interesting. You're Alan Stern with an M, U-R-M. He's Alan Stern, E-R-N, Nancy. One does wonder. Gosh.
So, but it's not unheard of. I don't want to sound like I was special or that was just a hook on the whole thing. Because if you are polite and you have reasonable responses and they have the materials, that's their function. They're supposed to go find what they can and they'll give it to you. And that's their public archive duty.
Yeah, but you know that's all changed, don't you?
No, because I've not contacted them ever since I made that first book.
Ah, because one of our analysts, Steve Troy, was in touch with NSDC, the National Space Science Data Center there at Goddard, where I took a whole bunch of people in many years ago, and we looked through films and archives and prints and catalogs and had like 2 days. And you could go to the head of the archives, and they would send you negatives. And you could have them printed privately, and then you'd send the negatives back. And then ultimately, he was able to borrow very high-end negatives from NASA to print in terms of enlargements and found all kinds of interesting stuff. Well, NASA has now stopped all of that. All the hard copy imagery from Apollo, from Lunar Orbiter, from all the missions that you used to be able to get on film and actually make analog copies so you could make sure there was no digital hanky-panky, that's all gone away. And the only products you can now get out of NASA or any of its centers or any of its contractor centers or places like LPI, which is in Texas, there at Clear Lake, is digital. And when I first saw this transition, I was horrified because, of course, digital, you can totally manipulate the universe. You can wind up creating anything or subtracting anything. And there's no validation with the original data that the U.S. taxpayer contracted with NASA to provide so that science could proceed on the original sources.
But that's the document earlier that we were talking about.
Yeah, that's, you're looking at Iron Mountain in operation.
You're right. So yes, matter of fact, in my cotton gloved hands, I had some of the last of the duplicates running around the world of some of the Hasselblad images that were outside of the cold storage, which ASU, Arizona State University up in Phoenix, started scanning at super
right.
high resolution.
They have a very elaborate project. They've been scanning methodically, the mapping camera stuff first, then the pan stuff. They're saving the Hasselblads for last. And I always wonder.
Or saving the Hasselblads for the never-ending, open-ended space project?
You got it.
Because yes. I've still yet to see them, and
me
they
neither.
Promised them years
me
ago.
Me neither. Now, are you aware of the story how I got access to some extraordinarily interesting Hasselblad surface photography from Apollo 14?
No, I am not.
I have a friend who actually is writing a book now, Ken Johnston. He's been on the on Coast with me many times and with Ari. Mm-hmm. He lives not too far from me here in New Mexico, and when we first met, which was I think in 1995, it was in Seattle. I was doing a speech, and after the speech, he came up and he wanted me to sign a book and all that. And then he said to me and a friend of mine, a colleague, Jay Widener, he said, "You know, you might be interested in some photographs I've got, you know, back at the house." So we got in our cars and we drove down to Kent, which is south of Seattle. Walked in and he opened these huge bound glassine folders, and they had not only prints but slides, color prints saved, and it turns out they had been saved outside of NASA from 35 years at that point, when Ken had been employed as a contractor through I think Brown and Root to the Manned Spacecraft Center there in Houston, and he was in charge of distributing the scientific photography to principal investigators from the Apollo program to accompany samples, little tiny samples of moon rocks, which were sent to these various labs.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And one day he was told by his superiors, because he had a huge archive of films and prints and negatives and all this enormous, he was told by his superiors to destroy, I repeat, to destroy everything in the archive but one copy. And he was young. I mean, I was with Cronkite at that age, 23, 24. He was 23, 24, working at NASA, you know, living the life that you can only imagine you could live if you were interested in this stuff. And something at that point made him stop and say, wait a minute, this is not right. So he took a whole set of what it was in his archive, put it in a gunny sack. He was a Marine. Mm-hmm. Put it in a gunny sack, took it home, kept part of it, sent the rest to his university library. Years later, after all this story came out, we tried to track it down. It's all disappeared from the university. The only 30-plus-year preserved data from the Apollo missions, which has not been in NASA's grubby little hands for three decades, was in Ken Johnson's stash. And the stuff I found on those images is mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling, because it was pristine data at a time when no one was thinking of covering it up, because they didn't even know yet what was there.
You know, a lot of people talk about the cover-up and possibly airbrushing or whatever that may have happened, or even in later years, like you were saying, when it went digital. I have to say that I can't imagine the sheer number of images coming back that you could employ with top secret clearances and crypto level clearances and blood brother bonds that they'll never ever talk about it, or they'll be killed. You just couldn't. How could they handle all those pictures? And I think that's the kind of stuff that I find in my pictures are that if anybody was doing if anybody had any time to do anything to these pictures, they had time to do a once over, mm-hmm. and maybe somebody to like kind of and that's what's interesting about the claims of the geometry that you've been beating the drum for forever.
Well, remember, all the photography from Apollo came back physically on film. There was nothing transmitted. You know, the TV coverage we had was terrible quality, so you couldn't see anything on the TV. Mm-hmm. So the film was brought back. It went to the photographic laboratory at the Manned Spacecraft Center there in Houston, now ironically named the Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center. And it all went through one guy. His name was Dick Underwood. He was the head chief of the photographic lab. So when you have everything funneling down to one guy, and remember, all we saw in those years were a press release image here, press release image in Life magazine there, a little spread in National Geographic. There was no web, there was no internet, there was no broad dissemination. It all got locked up, so they didn't have to do it, you know, quickly. They had decades to go and sanitize all this imagery as they leaked out little photos here and little photos there. But 99.99% of what the astronauts took never saw the light of day until the internet age. Mm-hmm. And then they put their archives online. And if you go through the archives, the thing that I noticed over the last several years is that more and more of the stuff that was on Ken's priceless original saved collection is now showing up in the online high-res, high-definition imagery, because the ground troops, not the management, not the people up top, but the ground troops are literally pouring this data into the archives for some reason. And so now you can take any high-res Apollo image taken by a Hasselblad, and it's exactly the same quality, give or take, that Ken provided me, except it's available to anybody all over the world. And if you apply even a modicum of Photoshop techniques to bring out subtle details in the dark areas or, you know, against the vacuum of space where there shouldn't be anything, and there's tons of stuff, you can see exactly what you and I have seen for a much longer period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And over those decades. Now, what I wanted to bring up was that psychologically, we're pre-tuned to identify objects that we're familiar with through a 20th century concept of form follows function, which was design crossing paths with commerce, with the viability of the thing being sold. And so the shape of a refrigerator isn't just the shape of a refrigerator because that's the most efficient shape. It's that that's the most efficient shape as well, economically speaking.
See, one of the problems I have with a lot of amateurs who try to do what we're doing, they send me images and they say, oh, that's a thingamajig, or that, right. that's an air conditioner, or that's an apartment building. Not right. Realizing that you have to abstract and stand back, and all you really can identify is geometry.
That's it.
What
that's all
it
you
does,
can do.
What it ever did, we have no way of knowing until we have ground truth, but the geometry alone sets it apart from natural things. And since nobody's trained to look just at in other words, you walk down the street in St. Louis or in Manhattan or Los Angeles, forget you're looking at buildings and cars and signs and light poles and whatever, and think of it in terms of the abstract geometry. The mm-hmm. reason it stands out and is so at the front of your consciousness is because it's so different than trees and rocks and rivers and hills. There's a stunning dichotomy between these two sets of geometry. One says nature, one says unnatural. And the problem with the artifacts that we're seeing is that they've been subjected to such incredible amounts of erosion and time and entropy that it's no longer pristine, sharp angles and sharp images and sharp edges. It's all fuzzy and diffuse and ground down, and you really need to be a forensic archaeologist to recognize the geometry amid the background noise.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Matter of fact, a Hasselblad full-scale scan should come into the range of the mid 20 megabytes. I mean, 20 megapixel, and as much as 25 megapixel. And many of the images that we see are only in the 5 to 8 megapixel range.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they could get any more detail if they were scanning the duplicates that were in circulation before they were just totally pooped out. Because I remember holding and scanning Hasselblad film positives that were turning yellow, turning green, turning all kinds of colors, you know, but they were the, they were as clear as they could be, but they were shifting, you know, and once everything starts shifting, something's going to drop off the spectrum. And the things that you and I are looking at are really finite details. I mean, we're pulling out the finest little lines and going, no, don't you see these little fine lines right here?
I see you've been through the same thing I've been through. Yeah. But you don't see that? That's amazing. That shouldn't be there, and you have your audience or people standing around saying, I don't see anything. Hey, Sally, do you see anything? No?
Yeah, that's nice. Pass the salad dressing.
Okay,
exactly.
You have a bunch of images. If you go on our site tonight, othersideofmidnight.com, and go to Alan's guest page and Robin's, scroll down to item number 11. That's a link to your site.
Okay.
Click on that. That will take us to your page.
So we've covered this page. While everybody's catching up, we've covered up how I kind of got into this. Mm-hmm. This is a little more poetic than I talk, you know, like live with you. But it's the truth. You know, at some point in this process, when I was getting more and more access to these pictures, I started to see a lot of strange things, which you'll see in the book, the simple stuff, lunar orbiter pictures, pentagonal looking white objects sitting on the edges of craters, and I had no frame of reference to it. I'm like, why am I looking at a pentagon with a dot in the middle? And it doesn't mean that it's the Pentagon on the moon, and it doesn't mean anything other than that. I was just like, well, I'm curious. So I went up to the U of A library, their science library. They got the hugest astronomy and sciences library up here. And I basically just checked out every last book I could find on lunar geology, and I had about, I guess at one point about like $1,400 in late fees, because I had this stack about up to my hip of books, and I was just, and I'm not a scientist, and I don't claim to be a scientist, but I read as much as I could read.
But you're an imaging guy. You recognize patterns.
Yeah, and that's what I was looking for. I was looking for, okay, well, they say this is a tiered wall of a crater, supposing an impact of this speed, of this size, and yada, yada, yada. Mm. You know, and I'm like, I get that. And I see their illustrations, and I look back, and I'm like, well, that doesn't explain why this sphere is hanging out on the edge of the inside of a crater.
Yep.
You know, and so, anyways, we can move on. And at one point, I was looking for something more than a pentagon, And that's when I came across the what I'm calling the chariots of the moon here in this picture.
Okay, so we're on your page. It says Introduction to ULOs 2008.
Right.
There's a book beneath it. You want us to go to the right and click on
number two,
chariots number two, chariots of the moon.
Right. And then you can actually, so for those with a larger screen, you can click on that, and it will expand up to about an HDTV level, as big as you want.
Clicking. Okay.
And there's two reasons for this picture that I'm showing here.
Okay, you have a side-by-side comparison. You have a black and white on the right, and you've got a colorized version on the left. Is that supposed to be an anaglyph?
It's actually a depth map process that it's a little different than doing a lute or doing a gradient scaling or something like that. There's a different level of interpretation that kind of gives you volumetric space.
Okay.
And so for this whole presentation, I have a series of these. But more importantly, those three looking Star Wars looking things down there,
mm-hmm.
like a better terms. I mean, I'll be the first one not to ever suggest what that is, but I will. I have to relate it somehow, and people call them wagon wheels. That's the play on it, is the chariots of the moon being the chariot wheels, you know, with spokes.
Okay.
And so
actually, it looks to me like the Lunokhod, the Russian rover, which was basically a metallic bathtub, and then it rolled on these wheels because the bathtub was sealed, and that where all the electronics and the cameras were, so they could be, you know, temperature controlled and all that. Mm-hmm. But it kind of does look like something sitting on a bunch of wheels, like bogies, like, you know, what,
right.
Three or four wheels on each side? We're only seeing one side, of course.
Well, so in this case, when you observe other pictures, there's another picture that's a similar a frame next to this, which is from a slightly different angle. I realized that those sphere-looking shapes down there were in the foreground, and the midground in the middle is whatever this collection is, and then in the background is this. I call it the wedged. This thing, that thing shoots up to the side of the crater, right?
Okay.
So now, so from this particular angle, they all line up like this, and you could think that they all kind of come together as one, but they're not. And that's what I'm trying to show in this picture. And that's the single biggest hurdle I've dealt with anybody that I've ever shown pictures personally, off the cuff, waiters or waitresses at restaurants, whatever. You know, I just be able to whip my phone on and be like, "Hey, what do you think this is?" And they see everything in 2D, right? Because we see the world as 2D, right?
Well,
and so as a crop without context to the rest of the scene, you think you see this as whatever you might see it as. And so, anyways, the reason I labeled this on the left was to so that all the other pictures that we might look at always understand that the elements at the bottom or any pixels at the bottom are closer to us. Stuff at the top is typically farther away.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Now, that was the needle that I found that my wife at the time, I made an agreement with her. I said, "Hey, if I find something really, really, truly interesting, will you let me make a book on this instead of the book of just the coffee table book of me taking pictures with my 8-inch telescope?" And she's like, "Okay." So that was my go. I could pass go and collect $200 and stay up till 4 a.m. looking at moon pictures all night. And I came across this thing and I sat back and I was just like, okay, this looks not random.
I'm seeing a sign that popped up. Resource limit is reached. The website is temporarily unable to service your request as it exceeded resource limit. So we've blown your website. Darn.
Really?
That's what it says.
Yep. Okay. I just got that too.
Yeah. And if we go back to all right, I'm back on your ULO page, your main page. Where should we – should we try another file?
Oh, wow. Mine's completely down too.
Well, we've obviously blown your website.
Resource limit is reached.
Yeah.
Richard, you have a lot of listeners.
Apparently.
I haven't had that happen to me yet.
Well, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Well, let's continue this conversation, though, because this will calm down. If everybody just stops clicking for a moment, it'll calm down.
Everyone stop clicking.
And it's important to note when we look at these pictures, right, that we don't clearly see the actual details, like you brought up earlier. So many people get so busy trying to describe what it is, and as you probably saw on my website, on the cover and on the bottom of just about every page, I'm interested in collecting potential candidates and just systematically tossing them out. You know, throw them all on the table. They're all equal. I mean, that might be fantastical, but to be real, this image may just end up being some natural formation in a low gravity environment in a moonscape with a dozen main chemical properties of the surface and under these conditions and yada yada yada. You know, I mean, really smart people could come to me and say, "Yeah, we've seen kind of something like that before."
Mm-hmm.
But the deal is that you know, to just open-mindedly have a look at this stuff. Now, Let me pull this back while hopefully the website calms down. Is that when I was hanging out around the archive here at the U of A, and this is I'm not throwing any rocks, I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I finally got brave enough to talk to the librarian, and I said, "You know, I'm seeing these weird things," and I showed her a few things, and I said, "You know, is there someone here in the building that would want to talk to me about him?" And I'm like, and let me preface this before you even answer. I'm okay with someone telling me I don't know what I'm looking at and I'm misinterpreting everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to, like, talk to someone about him and just show them this, right?
Okay.
And she's like, "Well, let me check, you know?" And so I didn't hear back from her for a week or so. And then I pinged her by email. And then she's like, oh, yeah, let me check again. And maybe like another week goes by. And she comes back and she's like, well, I'll paraphrase. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Oh.
And a little more research, because this was also when I was around the astronomy program and all that over there. Come to find out, they all vie for grant money,
mm-hmm.
and they have to write up these complicated proposals with, you know, like not like what we were talking about before with no end game. They have to have like a, you know, and we're going to achieve this and we're going to determine that and all this kind of stuff. And these colleges are in extreme competition. It'll probably never make cable TV as a reality show because it would probably bore everybody. But in their world, it's their reality show. And everything down to private websites, to everything could get in the way of them getting their grant money. And so nobody even wanted to touch the topic at all.
Well, to me, this is a perfect setup for how you, without giving anybody orders that you will keep everything secret, their natural inclination in that environment is to keep everything secret.
Yeah. Well, and as I mentioned before, that could be twofold. That could be this overlordish kind of manipulative, at least set the tone like a parent kind of thing, and you'll all behave kind of like this. Or it could be internal. It could be very group level and very, very, very cliquish. That's like, yeah. Maybe people have seen, you know, the priceless picture, and they're like, whoa. You know, I just had a reality check, and I'm going to hold on to that, and I can't even tell my wife. And here's this joker coming down the hall. I'm not going to talk to him.
If they recognize what they're seeing, I'll tell you what. Hold it there. We got a break coming up.
Looks like website's back up.
Oh, good. Okay, mm-hmm. You're on the other side of midnight, everyone. Just hold it right there, and we will be right back. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning is Alan Sturm, and we're discussing exotic things on the moon in the context of the official verification that the report from Iron Mountain, the manipulated programming of society to, among other things, not extend now into space, seems to be real. A reason for a cover-up, if one ever heard one. We'll be right back. Welcome, everybody. We are back. And the website, Alan's website, is back up. Obviously, everybody followed our instructions to stop clicking. So, we're on number 3, Earth-based image degradation examples. This is important. Take us away.
So, what we're looking at here, I wanted to train my eyes on looking at things that we're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Against what could be somewhere else. And this is, you know, just in a very abstract kind of concept. But I wanted to use Earth-based examples. And so we see, like, ancient ziggurats in Iraq, and there's the Pyramid of the Moon in Mexico, and there's Chico Canyon in the USA, and
yeah, that's just kind of up the street from me. Good old,
yeah.
Chaco Canyon. Actually, it's Chaco. You have Chico.
Yeah, Chaco Canyon.
There's a mystery.
Chaco's down below, and then
you got the both of them. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And then there's you can pronounce the Peru one for me.
Machu Picchu?
No, the other one, the Pachacamac. I'm sorry to mangle that, but
for all the Peruvians listening, please forgive us. Okay.
Yeah, I apologize. But what's important about this is that what we're looking at is, and anybody can do this in Photoshop or any other similar program. And if they take using just the standard run of the mill bicubic automatic transformations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you take an image of this resolution, of this size, and you drop that down to 10%. So basically, you're telling the computer to throw out 90% of the detail, and you get down to this little bitty square. Mm-hmm. And then you say, hey, take that little square and blow me back up to the size that I used to be,
yep.
which would be 1,000 back, right? And all of a sudden, it looks a whole lot like close-ups of the moon. And this is the key.
Mm.
Let's look at Chico Canyon top right.
Got it.
I see a lot of people say, hey, that looks like a tube, or hey, that looks like a smokestack. Well, yeah, it does in the blurry picture. But that's the result of this degradation of the image detail based on film resolution, based on the camera shake, based on in the case of the lunar orbiter pictures, I've found where the translation of the film is running by in the lunar orbiter pictures at a certain speed that's apparently based on the distance to the surface. And it's trying to catch up with that. Otherwise, you get a blurry picture, right?
Well, they had something on board called image motion compensation.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And if that's off, you get a skewed picture.
Yep. Now, right? what's interesting about what you laid out here is you're taking familiar geometry, cities, archaeology, ancient ruins. You're degrading the resolution. You're then bringing them back up to the same scale as the sharp picture.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, when they look at this stuff, they're trying to figure out what it is, what's recognizable. Is it a car? Is it a horse? Is it a,
right.
you know, in other words, if everybody takes one thing away from tonight's show, which is you can't identify what this stuff is, all you can identify is it natural geometry or unnatural, i.e. artificial geometry. That's all you can do. This remote sensing level, and everybody falls in the trap of trying to see something familiar.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, look at the Machu Picchu. It completely washes out into just this kind of white little space.
Mm-hmm.
If someone was scanning the moon to try to uncover conspiracies or looking for things, they would completely pass over that. They'd just be like, oh, that must be white stuff.
Yeah.
And they would never even realize, you know, if you actually worked with that, if you look at the top left corner of the blurry one, you start to pick up some grids. Now, there's some false positives right there. Because if we look over there on the left, that looks like, well, that might be modeled terrain from, you know, from human activity. But in large part, the central area is key. And this would be a hard one. But if we look at the bottom, we start to see the buildup. Now, this is another false positive on that Machu Picchu, is that you could start to imagine from this top-down view that we're looking down the side of a cliff. So at the lower third, the white line, the brightest kind of zigzagish line right there, could be the top of the wall coming down, and that down in the valley, down the cliff wall, could be this stuff that looks like geometry. But that's all being created based on these interpolation methods, and the interpolation happens in digital as much as it does in photography. Because you start to lose the capability of the film to capture the detail at something distant, and so things visually start to
pop up. I think it's called exceeding the Nyquist frequency or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, let's take the Machu Picchu picture, the one on the right. If I just came across this and it was on the moon, the thing that would really stand out for me is that little square on the right-hand side halfway down.
Exactly, and that seems to be a pretty good match to the real.
Because those kind of squares should not exist in nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if they do, it better be a whole lot of Mother Nature going on.
Mm-hmm. Like one of a kind.
That's not the case of the moon.
Exactly, one of a kind, a unique thing that's kind of out of place is a dead giveaway that it should not be part of a process going on down there.
Right, Pyramid of the Moon, that would be an obvious. That'd be like, what is that? You know, the ziggurat kind of like blows out pretty good, and you start to even get circling. As the algorithms are applied, or even the lensing onto film, you know, you can get the circling effect on the top right, where you see that kind of like larger circle, almost like a dream thing. And yet, in the original, we're hard pressed to see that because now we're all focused on the details and we don't see the greater circles.
That's right. See, you know? What I do with some of the imagery that I analyze, I actually deliberately de-res it so I put it through a Gaussian filter and reduce, you know, so I can see the big mega geometry. large-scale stuff that shouldn't be there, because if you're looking for detail on NASA imagery, you're going to be very, very, very disappointed most of the time.
Right.
So where should we go next?
Yeah, let's go to the next one.
Okay, let me back up here.
And you close that out. And yep. So I'm just going to show you
if
we were on the moon.
Okay, so it was number 4 on the right-hand side of your page, which you get to by going to othersideofmidnight.com. You click through on the guest name to his page. You then scroll down to the logo. It's number 11 is the link under the logo. Very nice logo, by the way. There must be a story about that. And when you click on that link, it takes you to his page. And now we're looking at item number 4 on the right-hand side, mm-hmm. If the Earth were the moon.
Now, this is a series of pictures, so it's a slideshow within here. So if you hover your mouse on the right-hand side, we can click through, or you can go down to the little dots at the bottom of the picture. So 1 of 5, this is that same picture of that ziggurat in Iraq, which is a fascinating structure, by the way.
Mm.
I believe it's Babylonian period.
Yeah, yeah. This is supposed to be the famous Babylon ziggurat.
Yeah, and it's fabulous. And if we click to the next picture, you'll see where I've merged a lunar orbiter photo into that.
So, So we go to the dots underneath.
Right, and you can pick number 2.
Click on the second dot.
Yeah.
And it turns open and in the center. Okay, now we're on the moon.
So I was trying to think, like, what would it look like?
I see what you've done.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, so if there was a degraded, ancient, super ancient structure, like maybe around since the dinosaur times, and then everybody packed up and left,
right.
What would it look like after a handful of craters, World War II bombing run had happened to it after zillions of years or whatever? And I'm like, okay, so...
Well, this actually did happen, the Desert Storm. We bombed the hell out of Iraq, and a lot of these things are no longer there.
Yeah, there you go.
It's awful. It's so awful. Just in an instant, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years of history gone.
Mm.
So you put craters on the ziggurat image.
Yeah, I merged the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so from here, it's like, okay, so what can we identify? And so if we go to slide number 3 on this same page.
Okay, so we click on the third little dot under the picture.
I can spot.
Okay.
Where those two yellow spots are, the yellow circles, I can start to spot things. So I'm just like looking at my mind, like, okay, so how do we start pulling this apart? And now you've already forgotten the original picture, but we're going to get there. And let's go ahead and click that fourth dot.
Fourth dot.
And we start to look a little bit closer, and we start to see the lines and picking up, you know, basic angles and relative shapes to each other. Right.
And that geometry, according to, you know, the patriarch of this whole study, which was Carl Sagan. Did you ever hear Sagan's famous quote about how this should be done?
No, but I heard you say it a million times.
Okay, well then I won't bore everybody with this.
That's good enough because I took it to heart because that's exactly what I focused on, and it made so much sense. It's like because the point that we couldn't get to earlier before the break was that we have no idea what these things could really be.
No.
I mean, outside of like a shelter for an entity to take shelter in,
mm-hmm.
Outside of that, we're really hard pressed.
Well, we don't know whether it was a church or a fortress or a mall, a shop. I mean, you know, if they were like us, shopping malls, lots of old shopping malls. But
no, we know it was art.
You have to look at just the geometry. Forget what it might be. Just look for rectilinear, organized, repeating geometry. Because and the scale is kind of important. Because if you look at fine enough scale, you know, crystals, you have amazing geometry. That's not artificial. But on this scale, there's no natural process that I am aware of that on the scale of thousands of feet or hundreds of feet would produce this kind of regular geometric architectural looking stuff comparing it to what we are familiar with here on Earth.
It can imply?
Yes.
But we don't have to know what that is. But unlike a crystal, that's a repeating pattern, and we're going to see it repeat and repeat and repeat, except for scenarios where it was forced to grow or it was reshaped by some other. But it's obvious. It becomes obvious to me, anyways. I don't know if I have all the words for it. If we click on the last dot on
the last little dot. Okay, there's the little dot. Nice little dot. Okay.
The reason that I have the green circle in the middle is because that particular piece right there is kind of a central piece to these two. And if you go back to number one or back to number two, you won't even see that in there.
Going to number two. Oh, yeah.
Right, and I wasn't doing that on purpose. I just grabbed a picture of the lunar orbiter from whatever. That's those strips of the film, right?
And I just
multiplied that into the photo, and as if to just muddy up the terrain. I mean, we lost everything that's in this giant crater in the bottom right corner.
Mm. You know,
I mean, there was stuff in the original picture that's actually would be there.
Mm-hmm. So these are basically simulations of ancient lunar architecture using terrestrial models to kind of get a feel for what it would look like if it's been beaten to hell over a few million years.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't doubt that at all. The things that I think that I see aren't new or recent.
No,
the things that I think I see are very, very old, like older than I can imagine.
Same here. Yeah. And in fact, this is why I'm really intrigued at the fact that they've not scanned the Hasselblads yet over at ASU. Because to me, all of this is interesting. It's kind of useful as a background. You get into the process. You learn the techniques. You learn what's a signal, what's not a signal. But I'm looking for images from the moon that are incredibly high signal to noise, meaning the noise is low and the signal, the artificial stuff, is very high. And I found that on the Hasselblads taken by the astronauts on the surface, looking at the landscape and then looking at space above the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's stunning geometry in stuff above the horizon that in no way, shape, or form should be there at all, ever. It's not noise. It's geometric. And, of course, flashing forward the film, in 2013, the Chinese sent their robots to the moon, Jade Rabbit and Chang 3, its mothership, and they've got two separate images or separate sets of cameras on these two spacecraft in color. And they recorded above the horizon exactly the same geometry 50 years later that the astronauts photographed with Hasselblads 50 years before.
Different
technology, different time frame, different government, different political philosophy behind that government, and they're identical. And that's, of course, on the Enterprise website called What the Chinese Really Discovered on the Moon. So there's an art form to doing this. And what you want to do, or what I wanted to do, was to maximize the signal. So my friend Steve has been doing what you've been doing, Alan, for like decades, looking at the stuff on the ground, going through zillions of actual negatives and prints from NSDC. And I said, cut that. You know what? I'm going to go for the highest signal noise, which is what's the stuff sticking up into space, which, although it's very tenuous and very faint, once you do the right enhancements, if you got the right source material, meaning the right negative or print to start with, it pops out and it should not be there, and there's no natural explanation at all.
Wasn't it here? I believe it was you that talked about the gold coating on one of the missions for the astronauts on the surface, and that would be cutting out the blue light or something.
Mm-hmm.
There was something, and that throws in a whole nother rabbit hole of puppetry going on. You know, these American baseball, American flag, apple pie heroes going to the moon, and maybe they're even being restricted from seeing what's really there. The whole thing is just
What's so interesting about Ken Johnson's imagery is there's a stunning picture on the surface on Apollo 14 where the astronauts have just gotten out of the lunar module and they're setting up equipment. And Shepard has a camera and Mitchell has a camera. Shepard is standing in front of the lunar module, I think in the shadow, because they landed early in the morning, so the shadow is like 10 degrees, you know, long or whatever. And he's looking north, and he's photographing Mitchell setting up the TV camera, and all around Mitchell, overhead against the black sky of space, what should be pitch black, on Ken's preserved data, on Ken's preserved 30-year-old print, right out of the, you know, manned spacecraft photographic lab under Dick Underwood, there's stunning, regular, tiered geometry. Glass geometry, so faint now against the sky because it's so beaten to hell, it's probably of the consistency of cigarette smoke. And the only reason it's sitting there, perfectly preserving the geometry. It's in a vacuum. There's no earthquakes. It doesn't shake and fall down. It's been there forever. And Alan Shepard photographed it, and Mitchell is under it. And when I confronted Mitchell with the pictures, with a show, with art years ago, Mitchell denied anything unusual was ever there because he couldn't see it. Nothing that he reported seeing that we can confirm now on the imagery, he could not report in person because he couldn't remember what it looked like around him, because he couldn't remember him actually being on the moon and what it felt like.
I've got something. I will bring up something that's very interesting another time. Hey, let's jump forward to a couple of the ones that I'm putting together for my next book.
Yeah, because we're running out of time here. We're about 10 minutes to the end of the show.
Jump to Elephant Head Crater.
Elephant Head, number 6 on the right-hand side. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we just went through another crash, but it's back up.
It's there. Yes, it's there. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. If you blow that one up.
And then we click on that. That blows it up.
Yeah. I've got this very, very odd-looking shape sitting inside of a crater with no apparent damage to the edges of the crater.
It almost looks reflective, like it's got specular reflection off it. See those highlights?
Yeah.
One above the other?
And where I point out A, B, and C, my mind naturally wants to see the right side. See that little white line coming off of the central object that's sitting on the edge of the crater?
Yep.
I'm just thinking that, just having looked at these pictures so many times, that where you see the little three holes for the bowling ball on number C,
mm-hmm.
or letter C, I think that might be going behind it.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, yeah, and I can't quite tell. It seems like it's up over the edge, but sometimes it doesn't. It really depends. But anyways, but without getting into those details, there's something very, very odd. And what I'll show another time is that nearby this particular crater, there's another similarly shaped crater, similarly shaped object sitting inside of a crater, in the same angle. And so two of them in the same neighborhood. Sitting on the edges of perfectly refined bowl, China bowl-like craters, makes you wonder.
Sure does.
We don't
have a lot of time, so let's do this. Let's go back to the main guest page for tonight, othersideofmidnight.com.
Yeah.
The guest page. Let's go to the very top where it says Radio with Pictures. These are three images now from Pluto, from the New Horizons mission.
Yeah.
All right.
Fascinating.
What I've done is I've given you the wide angle and then the middle view. These are perspective shots taken as the spacecraft was leaving Pluto as it flew by at 30-some thousand miles an hour. And then the final image, the one at the bottom, number 3, that's a vertical shot, color from the Ralph camera merged with the Lori camera, which is the high res. And the vertical shot of these, what I and my other colleagues were saying, are ancient arcologies, are in fact seen on the horizon of image number 2 above it. If you click on the image and then click again, you see those things on the horizon?
I think I may.
Those are not mountains. Those are huge, unnatural arcologies that somebody put on Pluto. And if you go back one image, click back, and then go down to the image number 3, that's what they look like if you look straight down. And they're missing their roofs. Look at all that geometry inside.
And why would it only be, why is it only on one side? That's very strange.
Because there's huge containers. They're contained cities, and the roofs are gone, and we're looking into the guts of what, God knows what it is, but it's geometry. Geometry, geometry, geometry.
So, Richard, do you think this is Earth 2?
No. I think, this is a very long, complicated story, and we only got a few minutes left. I think that the reason we're seeing Pluto with such geological diversity...
It was in a different place.
It was in a different place in the solar system.
Yeah, the plasma scientists
are
talking about
it. And they moved it. In fact, I think when all is said and done, and if you scroll way down on the page, there's a book. There's a little book here called Pluto that I contributed to a year ago, never imagining that we would be seeing this kind of data. In that book is a chapter called Pluto, New Horizons for a Lost Horizon. and it is identical predictions to what we're seeing, but I wrote it a year before we got to see what we're seeing.
Wow. Yeah, this is just fascinating.
Oh, and under that, link number six, that is a YouTube video, our first YouTube video on the Other Side of Midnight YouTube channel, of a program I did a few days ago with four of our colleagues, Keith Laney and Bob Harrison and Andrew Curry, and I'm forgetting the fourth guy. Anyway, that is our radio show with the pictures, so you can follow along. Spread it around, send it on Facebook, send it everywhere, because this is the beginning of the revolution that will kick Iron Mountain in the teeth, break the logjam, and open the system. Did I lose Alan?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. You're lost in the pictures. That's what's
that's
going
on. Like the end. I was like, that's the grand end. I was like, I'm going to stand up and clap and I'm in the credits.
Well, obviously, this is only part one of many parts because what I'm going to do now, with your permission, is to start sending you interesting imagery.
Absolutely. No problem.
And you'll be able to have the fun with all the rest of us of finding the stuff. I mean, it almost looks like Alan Stern has been listening to the show. So the day before the next press conference for New Horizons, which is supposed to be tomorrow, and actually later today, it's Friday, right? He puts out yesterday, on Thursday, these stunning side views, this incredible panorama. And when you zoom in on that horizon, those things on the horizon, they're not mountains. They are ancient ruined arcologies, based on the data we got directly overhead. And remember, we haven't seen the best data. The best data coming down someday is supposed to be 7 times greater than the color view taken overhead that is the bottom of this page, or bottom of this section.
Wow. Yeah. No, it's fascinating. When I saw these pictures, and there's that eerie glow from that backlit where the sun was on the other side.
Oh, the atmosphere, yeah.
You know, yeah, and there's definitely an atmosphere. And then, like a few days ago, reading, and this is more exciting than Mars to me. And
well, it's much better preserved.
It's so far away, and it shouldn't be like that.
But it's much better preserved than Mars. And again, I predicted the preservation because when they decided to save this place and put Charon in orbit and the other little moons and create a mini planetary system, I think it was as an archive, as a library, as a repository of what we used to be. And there's our music, and our program, Alan, has ended. I want to thank Alan Stern this morning as my guest. I want to thank Dr. Robin Falkoff for leading off the show, introducing us to the complexities and weirdities of Iron Mountain. We shall revisit both topics in the not-too-distant future. And until then, we'll see you tomorrow morning. And remember, it's third star on the left, straight on, till morning.